Welcome to the Vero Yahad Essene Scripture Forum. Controversial issues? You bet. Straight answers? Of course. Truth? You be the judge. For you're welcome to participate. Shabbat afternoons at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Log in at www.theyahad.com. See you there.
When Jackson was went to the Philippines, and I don't remember exactly what that time frame was, he had put up a thing by M. Scott Peck right before he left, and then we discussed it here in the forum. Myself and Allison were there. I think maybe Norman was there, or if not Norman, it was the professor. And we had I don't know what you thought, Allison. I thought it was a really great discussion. I mean, it was a heavy. M. Scott Peck's audio was pretty heavy, and then we discussed collective evil and different things like that. So we're going to play some of this. Jackson's going to play it, and then we'll just have a little discussion in light of some of the things going on in America right now.
The author of The Road Less Traveled, Book 3, Possession and Group Evil, Dr. Peck. Having come over the years to a belief in the reality of benign spirit, or God, and a belief in the reality of human evil, I was left facing an obvious intellectual question. Is there such a thing as evil spirit, namely, the devil? I thought not. In common with 99% of psychiatrists and the majority of clergy, I did not think the devil existed. Still, priding myself on being an open-minded scientist, I felt I had to examine the evidence. It occurred to me that if I could see one good old-fashioned case of possession, I might change my mind. I let it be known that I was interested in observing cases of purported possession for evaluation. Referrals trickled in. The first two cases turned out to be suffering from standard psychiatric disorders. The third was the real thing. Since then, I have also been deeply involved with another case of genuine possession. In both cases, I was privileged to be present at their successful exorcisms. These two were highly unusual, in that both were cases of satanic possession. I now know Satan is real. I have met it. The listener will naturally be disappointed, even skeptical, that I am not going to describe either of these cases in depth. The reason is that I don't hope to convince the listener of Satan's reality. Conversion to a belief in God generally requires some kind of actual encounter, a personal experience with the living God. Conversion to a belief in Satan is no different. There is no way I can translate my experience to make it yours. It is my hope, however, that as a result of my experience, closed-minded listeners will become more open-minded to the reality of evil spirit. One might think of exorcism and psychotherapy as utterly different, mutually exclusive approaches. The two exorcisms I witnessed, however, both seem to me to be psychotherapeutic processes, in method as well as outcome. Indeed, a week after one exorcism, the patient who had been seeing psychiatrists for many years exclaimed, "All psychotherapy is a kind of exorcism." And, in my experience, all good psychotherapy does, in fact, combat lies. The differences between psychoanalytic psychotherapy and exorcism fall into two categories: conceptual frames of reference, and the use of power. The conceptual frames of reference of Christianity and psychoanalysis need not be mutually exclusive. I have been combining them in various mixtures in ordinary psychotherapy for some time with many patients and apparently with considerable success. As to the use of power, psychoanalytic psychotherapy and exorcism are radically different. Traditional psychotherapy, whether it be psychoanalytically oriented or not, deliberately makes little or no use whatsoever of power. It is conducted in an atmosphere of total freedom. The patient is free to quit therapy at any time, and the therapist has no weapons with which to push for change beyond the persuasive power of his or her own wits, understanding, and love. Exorcism is another matter. Here, the healer calls upon every power that is legitimately, lovingly available in the battle against the patient's sickness. First of all, exorcism, as far as I know, is always conducted by a team of at least three or more. In a sense, the team gangs up on the patient. Unlike traditional therapy, in which it is one, quote, against, unquote, one, in exorcism, the patient is outnumbered. The exorcism team, through prayer and ritual, invokes the power of God in the healing process. For the non-believer, this may seem like an ineffective measure, or else its effectiveness would be explained in terms of the mere power of suggestion. Speaking as a believer, I can only offer my personal experience of the presence of God in the room during the exorcisms I witnessed. Indeed, as far as the Christian exorcist is concerned, it is not he or she who successfully completes the process. It is God who does the healing. The whole purpose of the prayer and ritual is to bring the power of God into the fray. So it is that exorcism is seen by its practitioners in terms of spiritual warfare. The exorcist believes it is legitimate to use any and every loving means that can be summoned or otherwise made available in the battle. Exorcism is psychotherapy by massive assault. Like any massive assault, it is potentially quite dangerous. In exorcism, one is dealing with very high voltages. But the simple fact of its potential danger is hardly reason to outlaw. Exorcism stands in relation to ordinary psychotherapy, as radical surgery does to lancing a boil. Radical surgery can be not only healing but life-saving, and in fact, may be the only way to heal in certain cases, unresponsive to more conservative therapy. Difficult and dangerous though the exorcisms I witnessed were, I cannot imagine how else the two patients could have been healed. I have every reason to believe that had these two not had their exorcisms, they would, by now, be dead. The two persons were dramatically different people. One was hypomanic and intermittently psychotic before the exorcism. The other was neurotically depressed, but eminently sane. One was of average intelligence, the other of very superior intelligence. One was a loving parent, one an abusive parent. The one who looked sicker had the easier exorcism. The one who looked more sane had the deeper possession and the more ghastly struggle for healing. There was a unique flavor to each of their personalities, yet some aspects of their possession and exorcism were strikingly similar. These similarities may serve as guidelines in understanding the nature of possession and exorcism. However, two cases do not a science make, and one should not expect a case to conform to such guidelines. From both these cases, I would conclude that possession is no accident. It appears to be a gradual process in which the possessed person repeatedly sells out for one reason or another. The primary reason both these patients sold out seemed to be loneliness. Each was terribly lonely, and each in the process adopted the demonic as a kind of imaginary companion. But there are also secondary reasons involved, reasons that I suspect might be primary in other cases. In one patient, the process seemed to begin with involvement in the occult at the age of 12. In the other, the process apparently began at the age of 5 with something more ghastly than what one would call ordinarily occult. Possession in both cases seem to create what psychiatrists call fixation at the age of its onset. During the exorcism, one patient, when the healthy self was free to speak, gave the most poignant expression of fixation I have ever heard. I haven't learned anything these past 20 years. I'm really just 12 years old. How can I possibly function after the exorcism? I'm way too young to be married and have children. How can I have sex and be a parent when I'm only 12? After the exorcism, the other patient, whose possession began at age 5, had to deal in intensive psychotherapy with all manner of five-year-old fears, misconceptions, issues, and transferences. Both patients were highly predisposed to their possession by multiple stresses before and after the onset of their possession. Both were victims of human evil as well as demonic evil. In particular, while both had been supported by the traditional church in some minor ways, each had been deeply hurt in major ways by evil people under the guise or auspices of the church. The diagnosis of possession is not an easy one to make. Neither of these two cases had bulging eyes or demonstrated any clearly supernatural phenomena before the exorcism proper. Both showed multiple manifestations of routine mental illness, such as depression or hysteria or loosening of associations. Authorities who encounter cases often like to ask, is the patient possessed or is he or she mentally ill? It is not a valid question. As far as I can currently understand these matters, there has to be a significant emotional problem for the possession to occur in the first place. Then the possession itself will both enhance that problem and create new ones. The proper question is the patient just mentally ill, or is he or she mentally ill and possessed? In both cases, the major distinction in differential diagnosis was between possession and multiple personality disorder. In these cases, there were two distinguishing features. In multiple personality disorder, the core personality is virtually always unaware of the existence of the secondary personalities, at least until close to the very end of prolonged successful treatment. In other words, a true dissociation exists. In these two cases, however, both patients were either aware from the beginning or were readily made aware not only of the self-destructive part of them, but also that this part had a distinct and alien personality. Not that they were not confused by this secondary personality. To the contrary, it quickly became clear that the secondary personality desired to confuse them. In many ways, the secondary personality seemed like a personified resistance. It should be noted here that there are cases where both multiple personality and possession coexist, where the patient has both disorders simultaneously. The second differentiation is that while in multiple personality disorders, the secondary personality may play the role of the whore or the aggressive one or the independent one or someone with other unacknowledged traits, it has never been reported to my knowledge as being frankly evil. In both these cases, before exorcism, the secondary personality was revealed to be blatantly evil. A crucial part in this diagnostic uncovering process was an attempted deliverance. Deliverance is a sort of mini-exorcism, frequently conducted over the past two decades by charismatic Christians to treat people suffering from, quote, oppression, unquote, defined as a sort of halfway state between demonic temptation, which the charismatics would say we all undergo, and frank possession. In one case, the deliverance itself was a failure, but when the patient was vigorously confronted afterward by a part of the deliverance team, which had originally numbered four, an utterly evil persona temporarily emerged. The deliverance team of three in the second case was successful after 6 hours in identifying a lesser demonic spirit and in apparently casting it out. The patient, not a hysterical type of person in the least, experienced dramatic, extraordinary improvement for 6 weeks, but then the bottom fell out. Overnight, the patient regressed to severe, life-threatening illness and shortly began to hear the voice of Lucifer. I can only speculate as to the reasons for the very temporary success of this deliverance. Ultimately, it is mysterious, but it did serve to strengthen our suspicion that the demonic was playing a major role in this person's illness. Something now must be said of the utmost importance. While both these patients demonstrated blatantly evil secondary personalities, they were not evil people. I never experienced either of them as evil. Not only did the core personality of each seem healthy, it seemed unusually good and potentially saintly. In fact, I admired both of these people very much even before the exorcisms. As I have indicated, they came to exorcism precisely because they had struggled against their possession for some years. A mature psychiatrist team member said, following one of the exorcisms, "I have never seen a person of such courage. Indeed, I have reason to suspect that the potential holiness of these two people was one of the reasons for their possession." Malachy Martin, in his book, Hostage to the Devil, that describes quite well five cases of possession, has labeled the first and usually longest stage of an exorcism the pretense. What he meant by the pretense is that the demonic hides within and behind the person. For the exorcism to occur, the pretense must be broken. The demonic must be uncovered and brought into the open. The overriding question during the lengthy evaluation of both these patients was, is this person truly possessed? To answer this question and proceed to the exorcism proper, the pretense must be at least partially penetrated. During the evaluation, the core personality needs to be both educated and encouraged. The encouragement is particularly necessary toward the end, because it is my impression from these two cases that as the exorcism proper approaches, the demonic activity heats up and the patients experience considerable torment. Once the exorcism proper was begun, with appropriate prayer and ritual, in both these cases, silence seemed to be the most effective of the many means used for the final penetration of the pretense. The team would speak either with the patient's healthy core personality or the demon or demons, but would refuse to speak with some unclear mixture of the two. It took some time before the team in each case became adept at doing this, for the demon itself seemed to have a marked ability to draw the exorcist or team into confusing conversation that went nowhere. But as the team became more perceptive and steadfastly refused to be sucked in, both these patients began to alternate between a progressively more healthy appearing core personality and a progressively more ugly secondary personality, until suddenly the secondary personality took on inhuman features and the pretense was broken. The final stripping away of the pretense brought the team face to face with the demonic. As a hard-headed scientist, which I assume myself to be, I can explain 95% of what went on in these two cases by traditional psychiatric dynamics. But I am left with a critical 5% I cannot explain in such ways. I am left with the supernatural, or better yet, subnatural. I am left with the presence. When the demonic finally spoke clearly in one case, an expression appeared on the patient's face that could only be described as satanic. It was an incredibly contemptuous grin of utter hostile malevolence. I have spent many hours before a mirror trying to imitate it without the slightest success. I have seen the expression only one other time in my life, for a few fleeting seconds on the face of the other patient, late in the evaluation period. Yet when the demonic finally revealed itself in the exorcism of this other patient, it was with a still more ghastly expression. The patient suddenly resembled a writhing snake of great strength, viciously attempting to bite the team members. More frightening than the writhing body, however, was the face. The eyes were hooded with lazy reptilian torpor, except when the reptile darted out in attack, at which moment the eyes would open wide with blazing hatred. Despite these frequent darting moments, what upset me the most was the extraordinary sense of a 50-million-year-old heaviness I received from this serpentine being. It caused me to despair of the success of the exorcism. Almost all the team members at both exorcisms were convinced they were at these times in the presence of something absolutely alien and inhuman. The end of each exorcism proper was signaled by the departure of this presence from the patient and the room. The critical moment of the exorcism is what Martin calls the expulsion. It cannot be rushed. In both the exorcisms I witnessed, it was initially attempted prematurely. I cannot fully explain what happens at this moment, but I can state that the role of the exorcist in this moment is the least important. The desperate prayers of the team are more important. These prayers are for God or Christ to come to the rescue, and each time I had a sense that God did just that. As I said earlier, it is God that does the exorcising. But let me amend that. Human free will is basic. It takes precedence over healing. Even God cannot heal a person who does not want to be healed. At the moment of expulsion, both these patients voluntarily took the crucifix, held it to their chests, and prayed for deliverance. Both chose that moment to cast their lots with God. Ultimately, it is the patient herself or himself who is the exorcist. Satan does not easily let go. After its expulsion, it seems to hang around, desperately trying to get back in. In fact, in both cases, it very much looked for a short while as if the exorcism proper had failed. The patients had returned largely to their pre-exorcism condition. Nonetheless, within a few hours, it was possible to discern a subtle but extraordinary change. All the old complexes were back in place, but it was as if the energy had gone out of them. The change was that now these patients could listen, and what they heard could now have an effect. In one case, psychotherapy became possible for the first time. In the other, more was accomplished in 50 hours of intense psychotherapy following the exorcism proper than in 500 hours preceding it. These patients moved extraordinarily fast. It was as if they were catching up for all those lost years. I feel it important to warn others that my experience of Satan demonstrates that it does not easily let go. Satan will not only tell the patient it is still around, but in one case repeatedly misled the patient into believing that it was still inside. In these cases, perhaps the greatest and most diabolic of all temptations for both patient and exorcist was to believe that the exorcism proper had been a failure when in fact it had been a success. It seemed as if the exorcism proper moved the patients from a position of demonic possession to what has been called demonic attack. The tempting, threatening, and frightening voices that each heard were at least as active afterward as before. But, as one patient said, before, it was like I was a little embryo, totally surrounded and hidden by them, so that I could not be me. Now I am me, and while I still hear the voices, they're coming from outside of me. Or, as the others said, before, the voices were in control of me. Now I'm in control of them. The voices only very gradually faded away for these patients. But what was not gradual was their improvement. Given the severity of their psychopathology before their exorcisms, the rapidity of their progress to health is not explainable in terms of what we know about the ordinary psychotherapeutic process.
So how many people were listening to that? He's got a little bit of a monotone voice. And I think next week, Jackson, if we could, unless you have something else planned or the next time that I'm doing it, there's a part later on in the book. It's not quite as long. I think probably about 15 to 18 minutes of a group evil segment. So this was more personal evil. And I want to talk about that. And then maybe we can get to the group evil side of it. And it had to do with the Vietnam War.
Right.
So first of all, just before I say what I would want to say about it, does anybody have any questions, comments, or snide remarks about what he was saying?
You may contact us at Jackson Snyder Presents at this email address, veroyahad@gmail.com. That is veroyahad@gmail.com. And let me remind you, you are listening to Jackson Snyder Presents with your host tonight, Bogdan G. Shrumkoff. Thank you for listening. We'll be right back. Jackson Slidell Present is back. Join us now for more of this interesting discussion.
It's almost time for 2019 Essene Bootcamp with Vero Essene Yahad. Make your plans to come along with us, enjoy the real Essene life for 5 days and four nights, June 6th through 10th, 2019, in the wilderness of the Smoky Mountains of Chattanooga, Tennessee. Enjoy tent camping with your friends and spelunking. Yes, we're going caving during these days. Experience a slice of life from the journey of the historical Essenes. Experience an original Essenic Pentecost service the 9th of June on the Zadokite calendar. Make the most of the feast this year for Enochians and Essenes and Nazarenes and New Testament people. The greatest feast of the year is Pentecost, Shavuot, Feast of Weeks. Spend your Feast of Weeks this year in a semi-primitive environment. Harrison Bay State Park, Chattanooga, Tennessee, with the Vero Essene Yahad. For more information, surf over to Essene.faith. That is Essene.faith. At that site, you'll get full information about our event, as well as a link to registration. And as a prophetic word, I say to you,
see you there!
You're coming, aren't you, Bogdan?
Oh, Brother Snyder, of course not. I'm way too old for that kind of thing.
Does anybody have any questions, comments, or snide remarks about what he was saying at all?
It's obvious that he's a psychotherapist and well-known now, though he's deceased. But this is a book that I bought when it first came out. Yes, the other segment with the My Lai massacre.
Yeah.
That's incredible. But this was incredible enough because what he gives you is, for me, it was a more standardized means of determining what one is dealing with in an exorcism section. That coupled with the other book that he mentioned, Malachi Martin's.
Yeah.
Oh man, that book, it's packed with resources, but the stories in there, all firsthand stories, they are frightening.
Yes.
They are absolutely frightening. But other than that,
does anybody have a problem maybe with the person? Well, maybe somebody has a problem with exorcism in general. I don't know if you would or not, but certainly maybe somebody has a problem with the two cases that he quoted or that he cited, that the exorcism happened when they grabbed the crucifix and the name of Christ and or the word of Christ, et cetera, et cetera. Does anybody have a problem with that?
No, I think as a symbol of wanting to change, that would probably mean the most to those people, you know? And would, you know, the things themselves might not have the power, but the person's belief in them would, if that makes any sense.
Okay, anyone else? Any counter arguments?
It seems to me that because you're dealing with the demonic recognizes the cross as what it thinks is powerful. So that would be my observation of that. And I'm actually wondering if I need to be delivered.
Okay, anyone else?
I wonder if anybody is familiar with the ministry called Discovering Mercy. Anybody heard of them?
No, I have not heard of Discovering Mercy. What are they?
Well, they're based out of Pennsylvania. It's a couple of ladies that have been in ministry. They go by the alias of Fern and Audrey. And I actually was on a call with them with a couple other ladies in the Yahad a while back. And some of the material based from what I heard from Scott Peck seems to me a little maybe outdated. I mean, he did talk about disassociation, but it's referred to as dissociative identity disorder, not multiple personality disorder. And what I've kind of come to understand from these ladies that have been in ministry, and you can check out their website, it's discoveringmercy.org. They don't have a whole lot of information on their approach on their website, but when I talk to them, it really what is happening with some of these that we go straight to the demonic, we go straight to calling out demons, whereas these are people that are suffering from this have been under some kind of trauma. Usually it's trauma-based mind control. It could have been, you know, human trafficking, some kind of abuse. And it really is a something in the brain that is actually kind of a, really a miraculous, to me, a beautiful thing that this is how they have coped and this is how they survive by disassociating with these different different kind of personalities, I guess you could use that word, that they are struggling with. And when they seek help, which is usually later as an adult, it's because they're not able to function in certain areas of their lives, you know, whether it's relationships or it's just practical day-to-day things or whatever it is. And their approach is, and these are women who have been involved in, quote, deliverance ministries before. And they talk about a lot of harm that is done in the approach that's taken through your traditional, and I don't know about Scott M. Peck exactly. I mean, some of the things he described there sounded like, sounded like maybe some of that approach was going on. But when I talk to them, they being believers, being experienced, having their background, you know, not denying that there are demons, there are watchers, there are entities that are influencing people, they do not give credence when those type of beings manifest. They will say things such as, I recognize you, watcher, and I'm not talking to you. And they continue to minister to the person. And it's an ongoing, long-term, they have a home, a beautiful home and grounds that people can come to. And it's more of a restorative type ministry with that takes some time. It's just something that's worth looking at and kind of opened my eyes to a new way of viewing what these people are going through. Again, it's really a small percentage of the population that has this dissociative identity disorder, but it's been a coping mechanism for them. And I think that overzealous, well-meaning people that want to just go jump right in and cast out every personality in a person, you know, there may not be demonic presence or entities that they're trying to cast out. And he especially talked about somebody who had improved for like 6 weeks, where there was an exorcism and then the bottom fell out or something like that. So I just think that there needs to be a little bit more education and understanding. Again, having, you know, knowing who we are as believers and the authority that we have is important, of course, but having an understanding of what these people are actually doing. They're not just inviting demons into their life. It's a part of the brain's mechanism to cope with severe, severe issues.
Yeah, definitely.
So, Marcella, just as a follow-up, would you say that the two incidents that he cited with them being involved in the occult and everything, would you say that those were not demonic or they were?
I think when there's occult references or background, that definitely there are going to be demonic forces because they've obviously invited those in and entertained those spirits. So yeah, I definitely think there would be that happening. And that may be exactly what was going on in those two cases that he talked about. I just want to make sure that people understand what this dissociative identity disorder is and don't jump in and think that everybody that has this disorder has been playing or inviting or entertaining demonic forces, because that's not the case.
Yeah.
The way I was taught was the shotgun approach. What he says is that the pretense has to be discovered and be discarded. The The pretense being the confusing array of voices, or the confusing array of what is actually there and what's not. And once that can be avoided, then you can get right on with the demonic, but not until then. And the shotgun approach is not successful a lot because that pretense is never discovered. You're dealing with the pretenses all along. You're casting out soul ties and this and that and demons of anger and all these lesser things and conditions. Another thing he said was that these people have been traumatized. And as you said, Marcel, it's a coping mechanism. But one point to be made here is something very evil has come into them at an early time in life, say 5 or 12, through the acts of somebody else that have disrupted their entire self-concept, even in that early stage. That was what was most interesting to me and gave me the more understanding about it.
Okay, anyone else have a comment or anything before we close it out?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I'm not sure if anyone's familiar with the works of Paul Hegstrom. Paul Hegstrom does a lot of counseling for people who've been traumatized, kind of like this. And what struck me in this, this guy's testimony is he's talking about how the victim will revert emotionally to a certain age, and that is very consistent with what Hegstrom was saying. He was sexually abused as a child, and so you find a lot of these people who have been traumatized in these things have got that time of either rejection or high stress, or again it's just trauma based stuff that basically creates the gateway and everything. And in his his experience in this whole thing, how forgiveness is tied into this. And this is kind of called out in the book of James, where it says, to confess your sins and you will be healed type thing. So this idea that between confession and then getting into the forgiveness, because you take on anger against whoever, whatever, has harmed you. And so the idea of forgiveness, there's two words in Hebrew, I think, that it's used for that. And one is salach, which is kind of speaking of and the other one is, I want to say it's nasa or something, having to do with the lifting, basically. So this idea when people confess and they say, oh, that it's like a burden lifted off. And this is the other thing he was talking about a little bit, is this sense of weight that's tied into this. So this idea of casting sins out, we think of it in English maybe is something figurative. And, if this is, in a sense, very literal, if that's what's involved, because, again, these people could not mature emotionally beyond those given ages until they forgave the person who had offended them. And again, recognition of that moment and where that is, that takes a little bit to unravel. And so, yeah, everyone has these other, say baby demons or, whatever, I forget the term that they use for these lesser things that are along the way, until you get into this issue of root cause in that one precipitating event. So that's what, that Paul Hegstrom guy had found. And that's it's probably a really interesting parallel study, I guess. So that'll.
Yeah, I haven't heard of him particularly, but what he and then what M. Scott Peck would be talking about then, as far as reverting to a certain age, would be clinically known as arrested development. Your development stops. You stop developing at an age when a traumatic event happens to you that you cannot cope with / let go of. I would agree. Also, one of the things that I want to kind of close it out with today and spring into the next thing that we want to talk about is an idea that I want to try for us to grasp, and that is, how does the non-coping / non-dealing with personal evil, how does that correlate to group evil in a society? Because it is my contention that the more individuals that you have that are not properly dealing with evil that happens to them, or that they perceive happens to them, whether their fault or not, then you're going to have greater incidents of group evil in the society where individuals aren't dealing with their personal evil. So next week or whenever it is, Jackson can tell us when we talk about, when we go further into the Vietnam incident here in this book, where there's a group evil happening. And when you hear what happened and what took place, and it's just mind-boggling that individuals who didn't know what somebody else was doing were all participating in the same thing. It's just mind-boggling. And to me, part of that lies in the fact that personal people had not dealt with some of their personal evils. And so then, therefore, this group manifestation can happen, although I don't have the particulars or even know how it works. It just seems like that would be a possibility. And then we'll bring it into America today and how there's so many things that the American church, for lack of a better term, is okay with, even though we say we're not okay with it. We are okay with it because we allow it to happen. So that's what we want to be thinking of, on the way to the group evil part of things. And again, and dealing with our own stuff, we have stuff that we need to deal with. If you have unforgiveness, if you've got bitterness, if we've got all these things going on in our lives, then yeah, you're opening yourself up to the spiritual, but there's also a psychological thing going on in every case. And there's not always a demonic or watcher thing going on in every case where you're going to have trauma and have to deal with stuff that you shouldn't have to deal with if you would just follow the instructions of the Father and the Son and his disciples, like Andrew said, James and different things, then you wouldn't have to deal with those. And we're still required to bear fruit, and it's harder to bear fruit when you're dealing with those things, so why deal with them? But anyway, anybody else, Jackson, you got anything before we get out of here? Are you there? Did you depart?
Just turn the mic back on. Only that we had to set up for the Essene shaman to come on. He canceled, and he said that he would reschedule. But next week, we're going to look at the My Lai massacre, something that I remember quite well. It was in the papers day after day after day in the late 60s, 67, 68 or so, and really caused a huge amount of commotion in the United States because of the fact that members of a certain community of the military in Vietnam, good people, had seemed to have been taken over by an evil spirit that sent them into a community of a Vietnamese village, and they massacred everybody there along with several other villages all at the same time, as though it was
a coordinated attack. And they didn't know each other was doing it.
Yes, exactly. So we have Scott Peck's assessment of that, and it brings a whole lot of insight into really what we're dealing with today, because I'm telling you, group evil today seems to be far more widespread than at any other time. Amen. Thank you for coming. It's been great again. Now, why don't you go take a little nap, Rich?
I've got to go get a haircut.
Okay. See you all next week.
Brother Shumkoff, could you come over and help me just for a minute?
Well, sure, I'll help you out, Brother Snyder.
I'm wondering if you would do the English of the Master's Prayer, if I do the Aramaic.
The Slotha Dmaran? Sure.
Slotha Dmaran.
The Master's Prayer.
Avun Dibawashmaya.
Our Father, who is in the sky.
Nithkarashmach.
Set apart is your name.
Tete Malkuthach.
Comes your kingdom.
Newe Sirianach.
Done is your will.
Achana Dibwashmaya af Bubara.
As in the sky, so on earth.
Aflan Lachma Disun Kano Yamana.
Give us bread for our needs from day to day.
Wavakwan Chaben.
And forgive our offenses.
Achana dabchanan shabaken luche yaven.
as we forgive our offenders.
Vela talon lunishona.
And lead us not to the trial.
Ela patzon min bishach.
But deliver us from the evil one.
Vitiel dadilache.
For yours is
Melkutha,
the kingdom,
Vachela,
and the power,
Utishbo akta,
and the glory,
Laolam,
forever and ever.
Amen.
Amen.
I thought that was really great right off the top. Didn't even have to rehearse it. And I'm sure it was efficacious as well. Us praying together.
Oh, yeah, I'm glad to help you anytime. As long as what you're doing is Yahad approved, of course.
Bashmael Nithkada Shmok Tethe Malkutoch Nehwe Tsivyonoch Icono the Bashmael of Ba'arro Havlan Lachna the Sunkanan Yomamo Washboklan Hobin Wachtehin Icono Dov Hanan Spoken Lahayobin Welo tahlan lenesune, elo patson min bisho. Mtol dilot him malkuto, wahelo watesbukto, lo alam almin. Amen.
Afraid our time's up today, my friends, with Jackson Snyder Presents, but we'll follow this on in the next show because I know we're all desperate to hear about sedition, bloody murder, retribution, and other acts of saving grace.
My friends and I have everything we need, and where I am is good enough for me. I said,